Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Almost everyone, at one time or another, has taken a stab at writing about a walk in the woods, sitting by a stream, thinking about the stars, recording the antics of a wild coyote that showed up in a backyard. We love to capture and interpret the world around us. Some people make a living writing about nature and the environment. In a moment, we talk with Wendy Holtkamp, nature writer and journalist, who is getting ready to help people learn to become professional writers. Get a paper and something to take notes. It's time to start writing, right now. Stay tuned. Want to be a nature writer or environmental journalist? A lot of people think about it. Most people are afraid to really try. But like any skill or profession, you have to learn the basics. In just a moment, we talk with nature writer and environmental journalist Wendy Holtkamp, who will tell you what's involved in getting started in this very hot new writer's market. And you'll learn about an upcoming online workshop she's offering that, as I'm sure you'll hear, can help you succeed. But first, a special edition of this week's Nature News. So now, the news. The southwestern U.S. has felt the effects of what appears to be an emerging drought. Communities which rely on the Colorado River or on snowmelt throughout the summer are talking with one another with a new sense of urgency about how to share the dwindling supply of available water. Los Angeles just asked restaurateurs to only provide water when asked. It's a small but very personal start to what may be the emerging accommodation to the effects of global warming. But recently, reports are coming in from around the southeast, which indicate that a similarly severe drought is being felt fairly quickly throughout the region. We begin with a brief news summary, then read from a selection of reactions to the story originally posted on the MSNBC webpage by readers. News is news, we hear a lot of it, but eyewitness accounts reveal the true feelings of those who are living with the new truth that water is becoming increasingly scarce. First, the story. It's been a dry summer in the southeastern U.S., which traditionally had to endure a series of summer tropical storms and an occasional hurricane. But this year, the area has been spared of storms, and a new storm is rising that eclipses the hardships of fierce storms and hurricanes, because without them, lakes are drying up, fishing holes are gone dry, frogs are disappearing, businesses are closing, and whole communities are wondering, what happens next? The area has seen an explosion of new development and significant increases in population in Georgia, Tennessee, the Carolinas, and Kentucky. Officials are now admitting that if the water shortages continue, the area will not have the water needed to supply the population. And here is what people who live in that area have posted in the last 24 hours to this emerging story. Senseless says, "The lake I live on, in the panhandle, is down about 20 inches. Brevard in North Carolina. One thing you failed to mention about the drought in the southeast, many areas are in forested mountains, and there is the added danger of forest fires. Here in the Appalachians of North Carolina, the native shrubs, rhododendrons, azaleas, and mountain laurels, are shriveling up too. It is a very sad thing." Slats, who is from Tennessee, writes, "As a Tennessee Valley citizen, we are worried. I live between two large impoundments, Cherokee on one side and Douglas on the other. We're seeing parts of the lake not seen since it was flooded over 50 years ago, and it is the opposite of the year it spilled over the sluice gates and had to be let out. First times for both, feast and famine, and all in less than two decades. It's slim around here, the water falling from the sky, can't remember when we had any rain. And if we don't get a wet winter, we'll all be carrying water in from elsewhere. And soon. Not really, but it is beyond serious. I can smell the fear when the spigot quits working and the switch doesn't turn the lights on anymore. I just know this, then, now, and future. We need to conserve. We've grown all fat and sassy, using and consuming without a thought to tomorrow. Well, ladies and gents, tomorrow is upon us, and it's right here, right now. Pogo said, I have met the enemy, and it is us. It's past time. We leave a little for the next day and time, and put back what we have taken. It doesn't really take much. Just think about conservation. 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 Put those dollars back in the bank, and watch your utility bills, among others, go on a diet too. I may be a hillbilly, but even a dog knows better than to mess up his own backyard. Tim in Alpharetta, Georgia says, I live in Alpharetta, Georgia, just north of Atlanta. I used to have a spring-fed pond in my backyard, quite a large pond, larger than my house, but it completely dried up about 2 years ago. It would get about half full during winter rains and has been dry since March of this year. My fish died. My frogs died. My water lilies of 18 years died. So, what do I do now? Add boulders and yucca plants? I don't know how to plan my gardening anymore. Should I dig a well? A really deep well? Brian in Virginia says, we, too, are in dire straits due to lack of rain. My county here in Virginia and others nearby have not had a significant drop of rain in over 30 days, and very little before that. We are now down to double-digit days left of water in our reservoir. We are currently on mandatory restrictions, and those may need to be revised even stricter in the coming days and weeks. Although conservation and restrictions help, without any rainfall, steady, not rain, not thunderstorms, we will need to try and purchase water from neighbors that may not be in the same perils as we are. I, too, see development accruing around the county with no reflection as to how they plan to water the new lawns that come with the new houses. Maybe it is a wake-up call to all of us. The earth's resources aren't bottomless after all. David, I live in Montgomery, Alabama. Normally a place that experiences plentiful rainfall, we have not had a wet weather front move through in a long time. Lake Martin and Lake Jordan have very low water levels, and plants are dying from lack of rainfall. Our situation is critical. Too bad the judges have declared God dead. Praying in schools doesn't seem quite so extreme now. Judy of Stopover, Kentucky writes, all the creeks are drying up in eastern Kentucky. Even the mighty Tug River is so low you can wade across. Those are comments in the last 24 hours about the drought in the southeastern U.S. We'll be following this story in the weeks and months ahead. It just seems there's a cumulative story emerging, one that we need to hear more about. And maybe that's a perfect segue into our next feature, because perhaps you are someone who can write or learn to write and help tell these stories. Nature and environmental writers are needed now more than ever. So to help get you thinking about this part or full-time career, we now head on down to Houston, Texas. All of us at some time or other have gone out, taken a walk in the woods or along a seashore or just in our own backyard, and been observing nature and watching things, and something has caught our attention. And there's this unique instinct. It's like a reaction. It's the human desire to write, to capture these moments. And it goes back a long, long ways, writing about nature. Certainly one of the greatest influences in me becoming a naturalist was about probably the seventh grade or sixth grade when I was reading Henry David Thoreau, and he was talking about the War of the Ants. And as someone who had always been intrigued with nature, I suddenly found someone speaking my voice, my thoughts, who was a very successful and honored part of American history. And I suddenly felt like I was part of a real world. This was a voice that was speaking for me. Really, America is very much defined by its nature writers, and it's a grand tradition. And it continues, and now as we move into the 21st century, nature writing is, in many respects, morphing and expanding into environmental writing, and we need it now more than ever. Well, joining me now from Houston, Texas, is a very successful nature and environmental author and writer, Wendy Holtkamp. Wendy, we've talked before. Welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Wendy, first of all, because Houston has been in the news because of weather and things, how are things weather-wise down in Houston?
It's drizzling today, but it's going away. So, yeah, there's been a lot of rain this fall. It's been pretty crazy.
Yeah. Well, you're an interesting person. You have a very interesting website at wendyholtkamp.com. That's WendeeHoltkamp.com. You're a writer, a photographer, and also bohemian. And I find that very intriguing because I consider myself a bit of a bohemian myself. But you have a great way of kind of defining what it means to be a bohemian. Tell us what you can about that, and then we'll get into more of the writing and environmental writing.
Well, my dad was a hippie, and so I don't necessarily associate myself with the hippie movement per se, even though I was raised by a dad who was a hippie. And so the bohemian title just kind of spoke to me because it's sort of like an intellectual hippie, somebody who can live in that world, who's progressive and a thinker. So I think I just like that title, and I like to throw it into my freelance writer, photographer, bohemian, because it's a little bit different and makes me stand out from the crowd.
You run your own path. You're not necessarily concerned about how the world interprets you, and I think that's what makes a person become at least a fledgling bohemian.
Right. Yeah, I think it's important to follow your own path, to listen to your own wisdom as well as the wisdom of spiritual traditions. I myself am both a Christian and a scientist, but one who does not necessarily fall under the fundamentalist or right-wing conservative category. So I sort of don't really fit into any box because I don't necessarily fall in line with, you know, the liberals always or the Christians always or the scientists always. So sometimes it's hard to live according to this type of, but it's really what we all have to do. We all have to find our own path and not just listen to our own wisdom, but listen to both our own wisdom and the wisdom of others and just continue to learn as we go on through life. So,
because I like to write, words and phrases keep coming into my mind, and you inspired me to think of the phrase, an intellectual gypsy. I kind of like that.
I like that.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to mention about the bohemian title is my name, Wendy, actually, you might be familiar with it from Peter Pan, but the word means to wend or to wind, and so also wanderer. And so that really fits my life because particularly in the past couple of years, I've really started traveling around the world and writing about, you know, I've been to the Peruvian Amazon and the Galapagos and, you know, all around the United States. And so I tie this into my bohemian roots because I'm both writing and I'm learning about different science and ecological field research projects and then writing about it and bringing the knowledge of these projects to people here in the United States that may not be familiar with what's going on in different corners of the world. So that kind of feeds into both the writing and the, you know, the bohemian title.
Great opportunity to live out your dream.
Yes.
A lot of hard work, though. And that's kind of what we're going to talk about a little bit, is this concept of becoming a writer, both nature and environmental writer. And you're a very successful writer. You've had over 100 articles published in some leading journals, including Audubon and Sierra Magazine and Discovery Channel. That takes a lot of work to be able to penetrate at that level. And I'd like to explore that a little bit in terms of what it takes to become a successful writer. That means to be published. Virtually everybody can go out and write, and we could talk about that. But I really would like to talk about more those people who have an inclination to do something with their writing. And I thought we might just go over some of the things that you think are most important. And maybe we'll start out with just what leads to someone becoming a better nature and environmental writer.
That's a good question. I think, you know, my background is I'm a scientist. I wasn't trained as a journalist, and so that's kind of a little bit different from a lot of people's path to become a writer. But I don't think you have to be a scientist to be a good scientific or environmental journalist. That's just my particular path. But it is very helpful if you are a specialist, if you sort of have a niche. You take a topic that you're particularly passionate about, and you learn as much as you can about it, and then you write about it, particularly if you're starting out and you want to get published. If you start out and you've been in community activism for some time and you can write about a topic with a particular voice, that helps you get published with that. And then once you've published a few articles, it's a lot easier to then break into other magazines. But you have to start out. It's sort of the chicken and the egg problem. You know, you want to become published, but you don't have any what they call clips, which are published articles to send to editors. So you've kind of got to get beyond that. And so that's the new writer's dilemma, is how to get published.
Talk a little bit about length of articles and sort of how you approached knowing the right length for a particular market. We'll cover some of these topics just briefly. And ultimately, I should mention to listeners that Wendy does offer an online writing course, and we'll talk about that at the end of the interview here for people who wish to utilize her expertise. But in terms of defining how many pages of typewritten text, double-spaced, do you think in terms of articles these days?
That's a good question. It really depends. When you're starting out, you want to, it's a lot easier to get published writing what are called news briefs. The front of the magazine, sometimes they call it the front of the book, they have a lot of, you know, timely news articles, and those are usually between 250 and 500 words. You know, they're very short pieces, but that's what most new writers have to write. So you don't start out thinking, okay, I want to write a little 250-word piece, but that's really what you have to do. The alternative is to write an essay, and unlike most articles where you typically don't write an article and then submit it because you never know if a magazine's going to want to publish that, essays are an exception. An essay is personal, it's got a theme, it's got you in it, and so that's a way that you can get published as a new writer. Unfortunately, you have to write it and you have no idea if anyone's going to publish it, but if you're familiar with the magazine that you're sending it to, you know, you try to fit it into their particular, you know, if they have an essay that touches on something with the weather. I know Audubon has an essay department that regularly covers some aspect of the weather, but it's a personal column, it's a personal essay, so you could submit that essay. Well, that's a difficult way to get published, just sending in an essay blind, but sometimes when you're starting out, you have to do that.
Let's get back to news briefs. If a person has news briefs, what do you do with those? Do you just send them out cold, or do you have to use some sort of query system, or what's the best way to go about that?
Right. If you would always want to send a query, unless you're sending an essay. With an essay, you don't typically query. You just write the whole essay. If you want to get published and you're trying to break into a new magazine, into their section, the front of the book section that's got their news pieces, you would send a query. And sometimes the query is as long as the article.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things, and there's an art in itself to writing query letters. It's actually sometimes the hardest writing that you can do because you have to not only really peg your idea, make it interesting, catch the editor's attention, you also have to say what you're going to cover in the entire article, who you're going to interview, and then a little bit about your background.
Fairly, this is the pitch.
Yes, it's the pitch letter or the query letter, and you... For a news brief, it doesn't have to be too long because the article itself is not going to be very long. If you're pitching a longer article, a feature, or a department-length piece, you talked about the various lengths of articles. Well, there's news briefs, which I mentioned are 250 to 500 words approximately. You've got columns or department-length articles. Those are usually 1,200 words. Now, you asked about page length. I'm not really sure. I just count the words.
Yeah.
And then a feature, really, it depends on the magazine because every magazine is different. But these days, most environmental magazine features are between 1,200 and 3,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
Gone are the days when you had the National Geographic features that were something like 70,000 words. You actually, there are a few magazines like the New York Times Magazine that, you know, Atlantic Monthly that still have some of the really longer features.
Let's talk a little bit about finding markets. What would you recommend in terms of helping people locate a broader spectrum of opportunity?
Right. Well, I just recommend that prospective writers go to a bookstore, go to a big Barnes & Noble or Borders that has hundreds of magazines, and just thumb through them. See what catches your eye, because everybody has their own unique sub-interest. If maybe you're into outdoor adventure sports, or maybe you are more into the literary type writing, or maybe you are into nature photography, you can take nature writing or environmental writing in so many different directions. You can write, and because the environment is sort of becoming a trend now,
it is.
You can write for a lot of the mainstream magazines. There's in-flight magazines. There's obviously travel magazines. There's really a wide range of magazines that people can write for.
Can you submit to a variety of publishers at the same time?
That's a good question. When you're starting out, most likely it's going to be harder for somebody to really, land a query. So when I started out, I would take one query, and I'd send it to several different magazines at the same time. But the problem, once you become published, you tend not to want to do that, because you kind of know magazines like to have some sort of exclusivity. So
yes.
If you send an idea to one magazine and they buy it while the other one's waiting, and the other one comes back to you and says, hey, I want that article, you have to say, wait a minute, I already sold it. They don't usually like that very much. So I tend to just send an idea out to one magazine now, wait till they get back to you.
How long does that usually take?
Well, it depends. If you're starting out, it can take, and they don't know you from Adam, it can take 6 weeks. I email all my queries these days. I don't use the snail mail anymore. But if I don't hear back from an editor within 3 or 4 weeks, I usually send a follow-up email. And I include the original query so they don't have to dig back through their email to make sure they got it. And if you know an editor, most of the editors I work with now, I have a relationship with. They know who I am. And so usually, sometimes they'll get back to me within a couple of days, sometimes a couple of weeks. But it's usually a lot faster.
So you've sent out the query and some publisher comes back to you and says, yes, we're interested in this. What happens next?
Okay, well, typically a magazine has their basic pay scale, and it's not going to range too far above that or too far below that. They'll usually start you out at a little bit lower than average, because they want you to prove that you can write, that you can turn in the article on time, and that you're relatively easy to work with. Those are the three main things that I tell writers they need to do. And so once you've maybe done one article for them, then they'll usually raise their pay rate or maybe after a while. But it's not going to range too much for a magazine, because a magazine has a particular budget. You've got your higher paying ones and you've got your lower paying ones. But yes, when you first get an article accepted, you'll say, okay, well, how much do you pay? And they either come back at you with I pay $1 a word, or we pay 50 cents a word. And then you say, okay, that sounds acceptable. And then you kind of can negotiate things like your contract, your rights, the rights that they're going to purchase from you.
Also, what kind of lead time do most of these editors look at in terms of articles? How far in advance do you have to pitch a feature that may have a time stamp on it?
Oh, gosh. It really varies, again, for which publications. So I write for magazines. The magazines usually are working anywhere from 3 months to 9 months ahead. So if you're, let's say right now it's October, they're probably working on spring issues right now. So if you're doing something about weather and you're wanting to write about winter, well, it's almost too late because they're working on the spring.
That's important to know, isn't it?
Definitely. However, if you're writing for newspapers, they have a lot shorter lead time, so they're working on a lot shorter of a deadline. And so if you want to write about something winter skiing, right now is still an okay time to pitch those kind of articles.
And then do they pay, I know it varies, but I'm just trying to get a kind of an overview here. Do they typically pay upon completion or publication?
Ooh, again, it really varies by the magazine. The journalistic standard would be paying on acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
That's what most of us who do this for a living, I won't write for very many publications that pay on publication. There are a couple here and there because I know they will pay. But generally, you want to get a magazine that's going to pay on acceptance. After they've accepted your article, and you've turned it in, then they send you a check.
Mm-hmm. Now, so you write the article, and then what about editorial rights? They can edit you. You have some sort of right. How is that negotiated?
Mm, That's a good question. Basically, you turn in an article, and sometimes you'll never see it again until it's published. Well, I prefer, because I'm very particular about it, I want my articles to be very accurate. And sometimes an editor can accidentally, you know, just change a couple of words, and it can really change the meaning of something. So I like to take a look at the article before it goes to press, and usually most editors will let me look at the article. So that's how that works.
That's kind of the basics, and eventually you get your check and you get published and you have yourself a clip, and then you can go from there. There's a lot to this, and obviously you cover all this in your course, which I'm sure a lot of people would love to be able to participate in. We'll talk about that in a little bit. How long have you been writing in this genre?
I've been writing for 12 years now.
I have to imagine that over this time you've seen some changes in terms of what editors are looking for, or style or intro. What can you tell us about that?
Gosh, I wouldn't say that I've necessarily seen really too much of a change in what editors are looking for. It seems like the environment is sort of becoming a trend in the last couple of years, but as far as, you know, I'm writing for environmental publications, which I have been from when I started out, they haven't changed too much. I would say, you know, they're still looking for good writing, original ideas, and a writer that, you know, is easy to work with and is not going to cause a fuss when they change little slight things in the writing.
Okay, pretty standard. I know that, for example, for a while there, the story, the seemed almost the messaging was a lot about the almost an apocalyptic sense of the future in terms of global warming. Now it's changing. There seems to be a different voice that is morphing into more of a let's get something done, let's unite, make things happen, let's work towards a sustainable future. It's much more acceptable to talk about positive things. This is my own observation, as I'm in the media myself, that I've observed through time. Any thoughts about that?
That's really interesting observation. I guess with global warming, there were so many apparent skeptics. I really don't think in the scientific community there was as much skepticism as the mainstream media made it sound like. But now that there's been sort of a sea change and pretty much the mainstream community has accepted things like global warming, yeah, it makes sense that the tide has turned and people are now like, okay, what can we do about this? How can we change this? How can we stem the tide of what could be in the future?
I know for myself and my messaging, I've had to kind of move away, and I'm glad to do so, of kind of giving warnings and trying to alert people to, and it's much more exciting right now, to talk about what can be done. Mm-hmm. But there's both sides. But we're also, for example, in the show last week, I was talking about the fact that the polar ice caps are really melting much faster than people thought. That's a real story, but it's very important for us to stay aware of.
Right. One thing I've always liked to do with my articles is solution-based. I mean, it's important to sound the warning call, but it doesn't do as much good if you just say, okay, the sky is falling, but what can I do about it? What can you do about it? That kind of, I like to highlight organizations and people that are actually making a difference, that are not just raising the warning call, but they're saying, okay, but I'm doing this, or you can do this. Because ultimately, solutions, you know, they make us feel, you know, it's positive, and I like to focus on those kind of stories that have a take-home message to them.
I'm glad we've made that change. Now let's go back to kind of the basics here. So now that we have the fundamentals and techniques of potentially being published, let's go back to how you actually then craft the story. I know that you like to talk about observational skills and keeping diaries. Tell us a little bit about the importance of that and why you think it is important.
Oh, yeah. One of the first things that I have students do is to keep an observation journal, and that's just a journal that you go outside and you sit in the place, whether it's your backyard or a park, and you just observe the exact same spot day in and day out, or week in and week out, because it's a challenge to look at a place that you've seen over and over and describe it in a new way. And I think that it's really important for nature writers in particular, and for any writer, to be able to really observe the people, to be able to describe the site, so that, you know, the best writing is when you're reading it and you feel like you were there. Well, how do you get to be a writer that can write that way? It requires being a good observer, being able to write about all of your senses. What are you smelling? What are you seeing? What are you hearing? What colors are there? What are the texture? And not only that, but how does it make you feel? What kind of thoughts are coming into your head? And because it's amazing what our mind will connect to a particular observation. We see a spider. Do we feel fear? Or do we feel awe? And just to bring all these thoughts into our journal, and when we're just free-form writing without our internal editor, then, you know, you can really get into the groove. And I think doing that exercise really improves everybody's writing if you want to be a published writer. So.
I know for myself, one of the things that I've learned is that oftentimes you'll have almost a fear about approaching a writing subject because you feel like you're not prepared to write about it. You've done research, you've thought about it, you've gone out and, you know, kind of experienced something, and you can sit around for days or weeks or months or years thinking, gosh, I need to write that article. And then I've always found this little magic moment where the moment that you actually sit down to write, it opens up a whole arena of information that you really couldn't quite grasp. This is my experience, and I've talked with other writers that it kind of works the same way. So perhaps part of the important message is write.
Yeah, just sit down and do it. It's sometimes I'm the same way. I'll do all the research, I'll do all the interviews, and I get a sort of mental block. I can't do this. Can I do it again? Can I make that magic happen on the paper? But it is, you just sit down, and I heard a quote, I'm not sure who this is, but I was paraphrasing, and it was, you know, that the difference between a professional and somebody who just, you know, writes, who's an amateur, is that the professional has to write. You don't have the option of not doing it. You've got a deadline. You sit down and you do it even when you don't feel like it. So, and when you do that, the words just come. It comes. And you just write a, you know, as Anne Lamott calls it, I won't say the word, but a crappy first draft.
Yes.
After that, then you go back and you edit it if you need to. You get feedback from others on critique groups, and you just always work to improve the writing and to make it better. And hopefully after you do it long enough, it'll kind of become second nature.
For myself, I find very often I sit, and the most difficult thing is that first line. I'm trying to find that hook, that entry point. What's your experience? What do you advise people? What have you learned from writers yourself as you've taught so many different people? Is that a challenge for others as it is for me?
Oh, yes. The hardest part is writing the lead. That is absolutely without fail. But if you, like you said, if you have the angle of your story, there are two different things, really. There's the lead that you're going to start your article with, and that can be really, really hard to sit down on paper. But if you know the hook, if you basically know how you're going to approach the story, then writing the lead can be easier. And one of the tools that I teach students in my class is called topic spoking. You can have a topic such as dolphins in Galveston Bay, and that's really just a topic. It's not an angle. But then you take that topic and you do this, it's like a wheel. You come up with all the different ways that you could write about that story. You know, a profile on an interesting biologist who's studying dolphin behavior, or how the dolphins use the shrimp, you know, feed next to shrimp boats. Or a personal essay about, how, you know, relating the history of dolphin watching in ancient Greece. You know, there's a million different ideas that you could write about one topic. But so once you formulated your particular angle for your story and you know it, if you can put it into a title and a little subtitle, because you'll see these in most magazines have a title for a magazine article, and then right underneath they have a little tagline. If you can write that for your article and you know what you're going to approach it, pretend like you're the editor writing the little cover blurb that's going to be associated with your article, then you've really got a good start, and then you can write your lead because you basically know how you're approaching it.
It's interesting how that title and subtitle actually put a spin, put a dimension to it. Otherwise, it's a little flat. You're right. Yeah. Good observation. How important or how challenging or dangerous is it to run your writing by friends and family and others?
Oh, I don't think it's dangerous at all. I think I'm on a critique group that I've always been. I tell, it doesn't matter how many years you've been writing and publishing, everybody can always improve their craft. If you want to continue to move on up until you're the best-selling author, a Pulitzer Prize winner, you can always improve your craft because nobody has ever arrived. You know, even until I've been on the Oprah show, then I will have arrived. But I can always improve my craft. There's always work that I need to do to make it better, and I think it's important for everybody to be open to criticism, particularly when you're starting out. You may be sensitive. You don't want somebody to rip into your writing and, you know, make you cower back and be like, oh, I can never show this to anybody. You have to both have sort of this core strength that take people's criticism with a grain of salt, but find the group of people who are going to support you in your endeavor to become a published writer, but also who will give you honest feedback on how you can improve it.
Wendy, you're such a straight-talking person. It's really refreshing. The information that you're providing is just so direct and so to the point. It's always great talking with you, and I just appreciate that. And we're going to talk about your workshop coming up, but you're also going to take a little adventure here, which is probably where you get some of your inspiration. I hear you're heading out of the country.
Yes, I'm going to Nepal in a couple of weeks now. I'm very excited.
Have you been there before?
I've never been there before. It's my goal to go to every continent within the next 5 years, and so within the past year, I guess, I've been to South America and Australia, and now I'm going to Asia, so...
I have to imagine you're going to approach this from a writer's and photographer's perspective.
Right. I'm going on assignment for a particular magazine. I'm writing about red panda, which are an endangered species. And, of course, I'm sure once I'm there, I'm going to come up with a million different story ideas. Mm-hmm. But it's always good to go on assignment because then you know... You know this is a tax-deductible trip.
That's a really wonderful thing, is you become a professional writer, and these trips are tax-deductible. This is called a business expense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, I'm just curious, in this case, did this come about through a query, or did someone who knows you approach you and ask you to do this?
Yes, it came about through a query, but for a magazine that I write for, you know, I've written for several times.
Wendy, you also offer a wonderful online course. Give people some details on how they can follow up and contact you and see if it's appropriate and hopefully sign up.
Sure. I have a 6-week online writing class. I believe the next one starts November 24th, and it runs for 6 weeks. And I cover all these topics ranging from writing and how to improve your writing to how to know a nature magazine or an environmental magazine through and through, so that when you pitch them, the editor knows that you're familiar with the magazine, and then how to come up with ideas, and how to develop a query. And one of the things that I offer in the class is Q&As or interviews, in-depth interviews with about 20 different magazine editors from Audubon, Smithsonian, Sierra Magazine, and E, the Environmental Magazine, so that you can know what these editors are looking for.
Now, are these live or are they pre-recorded? How do you do that?
They're actually Q&A, so it's just a printed interview with this editor. There's 10 questions, and, you know, the students come up with the questions, but I already have them from all the past classes. And usually in every class, if there's a particular interest in a magazine, I'll then approach that editor. If it's an editor of a magazine that I don't have a Q&A yet for, I'll say, hey, you know, Mr. Editor, Ms. Editor, are you willing to do a Q&A because the student is interested? So I'm always expanding the number of interviews that I have for the class, but all the previous ones are available to any student that signs up.
Mm-hmm. And what's the process of signing up?
You go to my website, which is wendyholtkamp.com, as you mentioned. It's wendyholtkamp.com, and you'll see a link for Do What You Love, Learn How to Write and Get Published. And there's, you know, a PayPal link on there. There's information on how to sign up on there.
Wendy, it's always good talking with you. One of these days, it would be fun to talk with you about one of your topics, so something that you write about. That would be really exciting. Maybe when you get back from Nepal and you have some things that you've worked on, we might talk again. Safe journey.
Thank you.
We'll talk again soon. Wendy Holtkamp, you can find out more about her at www.wendyholtkamp.com. Wendy, thanks a lot.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Lying on the roof, counting the suns that fill the sky, I wonder if
you are a writer, beginning or advanced, I'm happy to bring your stories to life here on the Wild Side News. Send me a brief email with a short feature, and if it's appropriate, I'll make it a part of one of our shows. You can contact me at wildsidenews@cox.net. Time to put a wrap on this one, so this is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday or anytime on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world here on the Wild Side News.